Hello, and welcome to today's session on Brexit and dispute resolution. My name is Adam Sannett, and I'm a Knowledge Director at Norton Rose Fulbright. In today's session, we want you to keep in mind that the key point for us is going to be what has changed, what are the differences between the regime before Brexit and after Brexit. And with that focus in mind, we're going to have one paradigm fact situation that we'll be looking at, which is where you have a contract and that contract has a choice of jurisdiction within it. With that in mind, we'll be covering the following areas. Firstly, governing law, choice of governing law. And then also looking at jurisdiction and enforcement. We'll see that there's a patchwork of different rules that relate to jurisdiction and enforcement. And so within that topic, we'll be covering the general framework, both before and after Brexit, and then also a set of different regimes, the Brussels regime, the Hague Choice of Court Convention, the general common law rules that could apply in England, and then also we'll look forward to the Lugano Convention. But firstly, we will go on to look at what the position is now, where we are now.
Thanks, Adam. So we'll move to the slide entitled Where Are We Now? The transitional period under the UK and EU withdrawal agreement applied until the 31st of December 2020. And the UK left the EU on the 31st of January 2020. And following the signing of the UK and EU trade and cooperation agreement, we were all hoping that there would be quite a bit on civil justice, but it is currently generally silent on matters of civil justice. So just to flag, as Adam has, that during the course of this webinar, we're not going to be covering anything to do with criminal proceedings and specific topic areas that relate to consumers, insurance and employment contracts. So these are just issues that are particularly relevant to civil and commercial matters. Now, in the absence of an agreement, as matters currently stand on civil justice reciprocity, the process that hitherto applied between the UK and the EU regarding the automatic recognition and enforcement of English choice of court clauses and English court judgments effectively falls away. So during the course of this webinar, we're going to be exploring each of those three areas and identifying exactly how the process has changed so that those of you who are advising either in private practice or indeed in-house can have the basic fundamentals, if you will, to help you answer those sorts of questions that will inevitably be coming up much more frequently. And as a further note, we'll also not be covering specific provisions that relate to insolvency. So over to governing law. Before the 31st of December 2020, Rome 1 and Rome 2 applied to contractual and non-contractual obligations such that the choice of parties to elect a particular governing law of a EU country or indeed a third country, it didn't matter where it was from, would be the governing law of the contract, with only certain very minimal exceptions to that in relation to mandatory laws of the forum and indeed mandatory provisions of local law. Now, the position effectively doesn't change an enormous amount following Brexit practically, and that is because from the 1st of January 2021, Rome 1 and Rome 2 have been incorporated into UK domestic law with only minor amendments. And indeed, there are relatively narrow grounds again to displace the choice of governing law. And for that, you can see Articles 3.3 and 3.4 of indeed Rome 1. In terms of how this is actually going to play out in practice, the reality is that for all contracts that were entered into prior to Brexit and following the relevant date for the application of Rome 1 and Rome 2, which is the 17th of December 2009, English courts are effectively going to have to apply Rome 1 and Rome 2, the EU version, as it applied as at the 31st of December 2020. And in relation to any contracts concluded after that date, then it will be a matter of applying the UK version of Rome 1 and Rome 2. Now, what will also be very interesting, and Adam will come on to this in more detail shortly, is that the likelihood of divergence in relation to the approaches that the English courts and indeed the European courts may take to these questions may vary as time goes on, and indeed case law develops from both of those sides. So over to you, Adam, for the second part of governing law.
Yes, I've been quite surprised by the amount of discussion there's been on whether choice of governing law should change, given how subtle these differences are. Have you been surprised by that as well over the last few years?
It has been interesting to me that it's more recently that we are seeing an increasing number of questions about whether or not parties should continue to use English law in certain scenarios, and particularly as certain clients, particularly in the financial institutions and asset management sectors, have, for example, established EU hubs, looking at where business is being conducted, where services are being provided, where damages may in fact occur, where judgments may need to be enforced. Questions around whether or not a choice of English law remains the most appropriate have been cropping up, I would say, increasingly frequently since Brexit. I have not seen a significant shift away from the choice of English law as matters currently stand, but I have seen, and I would say even over the last few weeks, an increase in questions from clients as to comparisons between English law and, say, the law of those countries where those hubs are located. So predominantly, whether it's German law, whether it's Irish law, whether it's French law, etc. And particularly, for example, in the derivative space, where you have other options now in terms of industry templates, that is something that we see increasingly frequently.
Yeah, exactly. And we've seen the same, and those sorts of analyses that go to English law and it being a commercial choice of law. Obviously, all of that hasn't changed at all, and we have these subtle differences, and yet there's a sort of quite a focus on those. So it's interesting to have that, and it then perhaps goes and gets tied into the choice of courts, and this is on the next slide to make the point that the choice of English law that we're looking at here is quite separate from the choice of courts. But as Elizabeth is saying, when you choose a governing law, whether it's an English law or another law, one of the ways that can not be given full effect to is that there might be other rules that the court applies in addition, due to Article 3.3, Article 3.4, Article 9 under the Rome Regulation, and so on. But another area is that if you go to a court and that court is being asked to apply a governing law that is not the law of that jurisdiction, will it do so effectively? Will it do so in a competent way? And is there a possibility that it will still apply rules of its own forum? And there are provisions specifically for public policy rules of the forum to apply, and that's something to be looked at. But certainly, from an English perspective, can an English court apply a foreign governing law? Not only can it do so, but that happens on a daily basis. And the English judges are very used to taking expert evidence on what the content of foreign law is, and then giving a judgment that applies that foreign governing law. In principle, the same should apply to a foreign court as well, in that you would expect a foreign court to be able to do the same for English law or another governing law. But it's obviously been a consideration when making that choice. And in fact, the chain of reasoning is, if you are not confident that the judges in a particular jurisdiction are able to or will comply with that and will apply a foreign governing law effectively, that's quite a telling point in itself as to whether to choose that jurisdiction or not. You certainly want to start with a court that will work in a commercial, clear, just manner and apply the rules that you want it to apply. So although the overall on governing law, these differences are quite subtle, they've opened up these areas of debate, and it's important to keep those general considerations in mind.
Out of interest, Adam, I've also had a number of questions coming in recently about whether it is advisable or not to split a governing law and a jurisdiction clause for indeed some of the reasons that you've highlighted. What's your view on that?
Well, the You, As in having separate clauses or having separate sets of rules, one
exactly,
English, one France.
That's exactly right. So having choice of law of one jurisdiction and indeed a jurisdiction clause in favour of another.
Yeah. So, well, that is something that in principle is entirely a valid thing to do. And it is unavoidable in many contexts if you have a cross-border transaction and there are parties in different countries, and you might have security documents which have to have different jurisdictions or different governing laws. But what's important is to choose a court that is able effectively to apply those different governing laws and has the expertise by expert evidence or however else it works, to apply that governing law effectively and to manage the risk of applying rules of the forum as well. It's a risk management point for the court that you choose there as to the different sets of rules that apply, because if you can't be certain as to the particular set of rules that are going to apply, that's quite a basic and radical risk that the parties are undertaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
So should we move on to jurisdiction and judgments?
Yes. So moving on to the next slide, in order to really highlight the changes that Brexit brings about, it's probably sensible to just set out the landscape, if you will, of the legislative framework in place prior to Brexit in relation to the enforcement and recognition of jurisdiction and judgments. And the reason we take these two particular topic areas together is because, as you'll see on this slide, the specific pieces of European legislation that deal with jurisdiction also deal with the enforcement of judgments obtained pursuant to the enforcement of that choice of court clause. Now, the way that we've divided this up is in terms of the proceedings between a entity that is domiciled in the UK versus entities that are domiciled in other parts of Europe and indeed third countries. So looking at proceedings between the UK versus an entity from an EU member state, the recast Brussels regulation applied such that there was mutual recognition and enforcement of choice of court clauses and judgments. And importantly, choice of court clauses could be exclusive jurisdiction clauses, they could be non-exclusive jurisdiction clauses, and indeed they could be asymmetric clauses, so in favour of one party over the other, in terms of where they were permitted to bring proceedings. Now, in relation to what we call the EFTA states, so Switzerland, Iceland, Norway, and Liechtenstein, the Lugano Convention 2007 was in place. And again, there was automatic mutual recognition and enforcement of choice of court clauses in relatively the same way as recast, as well as judgments. The point to note, and it's the way that I think about Lugano, is it's a slightly sort of earlier software version, if you will, of recast, such that certain of the Lisbon protection, so parallel proceedings, don't appear in the same way in Lugano as they do in recast. So you don't get that full protection against what was termed the Italian torpedo. Now, in relation to the UK versus Hague contracting states, so these are contracting parties that had signed up to the Hague Choice of Court Convention 2005, which is referenced frequently in the post-Brexit landscape. Now, prior to Brexit, Hague only applied in relation to proceedings between the UK versus Mexico, Singapore and Montenegro. Now, the reason for this is because of a particular article in Hague, which effectively states that to the extent that proceedings were in place between parties who, whilst also signatories to Hague, were signatories of either the recast Brussels regulation or the Lugano Convention, then it would be those pieces of legislation that would apply over and above the Hague Choice of Court Convention. So in practice, and certainly prior to Brexit, I think we'd only seen one, potentially two decisions, but one decision in particular, the Singaporean High Court, in relation to the enforcement of a judgment pursuant to the Hague Choice of Court Convention. Now, Adam's going to come on momentarily to talk about the specific, shall we say, restrictions in place under Hague when you compare it to the recast Brussels regulation and the Lugano Convention, but effectively Hague provides for mutual recognition and enforcement of jurisdiction clauses and judgments which are exclusive only. So they have to qualify as an exclusive choice of court agreement as defined by Hague. So the points here are clearly that there isn't an enormous track record, shall we say, of the Hague Choice of Court Convention being applied in practice. Finally, prior to Brexit, in proceedings between the UK and a third country, it came down to a matter of national law. So subject to there being a specific bilateral treaty in place that determined the process for recognising and enforcing a choice of court clause or indeed a judgment in that particular jurisdiction, it would come down to a matter of national law as to whether or not a third country's choice of court clause, third country judgment would be enforceable. Moving on to the next slide, as you can see, and we tried to identify some of these in green on the previous slide where there was automatic recognition and enforcement, you'll see that post-Brexit, the landscape changes quite significantly when you're dealing with proceedings between the UK and any of the countries named there. So in terms of proceedings between the UK and the EU, recast Brussels regulation no longer applies and neither does the Lugano Convention. So the Hague Choice of Court Convention 2005 or national law will apply between the UK and the EU. Now, remembering that the Hague Choice of Court Convention only applies to exclusive choice of court agreements, which, and again, Adam's going to come on to this in a bit more detail, entered into after the 1st of January 2021, if you're adopting a cautious approach, given the EU Commission's position in that regard, it will come down to a matter of national law if Hague doesn't apply. Again, in relation to EFTA states, Hague does not apply to EFTA states, so it will be a matter of national law, so no mutual recognition unless there is a bilateral treaty in place, or indeed it's permitted pursuant to national law. In relation to the Mexico, Singapore and Montenegro, effectively the balance of the Hague contracting states beyond the EU, its Hague Choice of Court Convention. And finally, in relation to proceedings between the UK and a third country, it remains a matter of national law, the extent to which choice of court clauses and judgments will be applied. So summarising all of this, it's quite clear that there is no longer automatic recognition and enforcement of choice of court clauses or judgments between the UK and the EU and EFTA states following Brexit. And it will become a bit more of a patchwork quilt, if you will, of working out exactly what may be relevant when determining whether or not a choice of court clause or indeed English judgment will be enforceable between the UK and the EU following Brexit.
And that's quite a distinction there from the governing law situation where the UK government made a decision, we're going to apply Rome regulation, and things have continued similarly to before. Here, there's quite a significant change, and the government couldn't simply or really didn't have the choice to carry on with the previous regime, did they?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So it was interesting, certainly in the run-up to Brexit, getting a bit more of an understanding around the pieces of legislation that the UK could effectively accede in its own right. It didn't require reciprocity, it didn't require agreement from the other EU member states. And so that's why the Hague Convention was relatively easy to ratify. It didn't require anyone's permission, if you will. But the reason why, and we'll come on to this obviously later in the presentation, Lugano recast that all required approval and effectively to be okayed by EU member states. And of course, given that the position of the CJEU was such a political hot potato, as it were, during the Brexit negotiations, it's unsurprising that we are currently in the situation that the UK is in terms of accession to those pieces of legislation.
Yeah, because of course the CJEU, the final arbiter on the recast regulation, and if there's going to be a reciprocal set of arrangements between different parties, then while respecting each other's courts, they also have to have a final arbiter. And without that final arbiter, it's hard to see how you could have a solution that doesn't involve just different sets of rules.
That's exactly it. So again, the case of sort of divergence between the UK and the EU is frankly at the moment unavoidable as far as I can see.
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, it doesn't need to follow that things won't work anymore, or in fact, in particular fact situations, that you will get a different result. It's just that the path is going to be a bit more complicated.
That's right. And indeed, if you look at it from an EU court perspective, and again, certainly following Brexit, I, for one, have understood a lot more about the process in place in EU jurisdictions, whether it be France, Germany, Italy, what the process would be in order to enforce an English judgment in this post-Brexit landscape. And as you say, generally speaking, the practical effect is that it may take longer, it may cost more, the process itself is more complex. We're all going to have to really get to grips with what that looks like. But I think, with the exception of one or two specific EU jurisdictions that, for example, have made it clear that they will not enforce English court judgments, English choice of court clauses that are asymmetric, for example, then generally speaking, English choice of court clauses and judgments will, for now, remain in principle enforceable across the EU.
Yeah. So as you say, it's a sort of a more complex landscape now, which we just have to engage with. That doesn't necessarily mean the risks are greater, but they certainly are different. And to get to grips with that, I think we have to kind of drill down one more level and look at each of those sets of rules, don't we?
Absolutely. And I think it's really important now more than ever, you know, practically at the outset of proceedings, so whether it's that you're considering issue proceedings or you're already notified that you may be received on the receipt of proceedings imminently, I think these factors are really going to have to be incorporated as part of your litigation strategy. So knowing, for example, where there may be enforceability risk, operating at a very early stage where you know another jurisdiction is going to be relevant, to get practical tips on how to manage the procedure at the outset of proceedings, rather than waiting further down the line, knowing you're going to, for example, have to enforce your judgment, let's say in Italy or Germany or France, and knowing that there may be requirements by, for example, a French court to recognise and enforce an English judgment. For example, you'll need at the very least a French translation of that judgment. So understanding and knowing those practical points sooner rather than later, I think, just will hopefully mean that you mitigate the risks of complexity that the new process brings.
Yeah, exactly. So we should probably look at, drill down to some of those particular levels.
Absolutely.
And you've mentioned the Hague Choice of Court Convention. So let's move on now and look at the Hague Choice of Court Convention. As Elizabeth said, the basic message to take from this particular part of the patchwork is that it applies to exclusive jurisdiction clauses. It's subject to limited exceptions, but if we're dealing with a commercial transaction, as here, it's unlikely you will fall within any of those exceptions. If you have an exclusive jurisdiction clause, it will be subject to the mandatory rules that it will be applied and respected by courts that are subject to the convention. And that applies not only to jurisdiction, but it also applies to enforcement. So there will be expeditious enforcement of judgments that are obtained pursuant to contracts that have exclusive choice of courts clauses in them. So if you take, for instance, the situation of a choice of French jurisdiction, and that might come before the English courts, in that situation, the English courts would be obliged to stay their proceedings in favour of the French courts. And if it came before the French courts, the French courts would be obliged to accept jurisdiction under that exclusive jurisdiction clause. That's the operation of the Hague Choice of Courts Convention. It's a mandatory form of jurisdiction. And so it operates as a sort of safe harbour. If you can bring it within that, a lot of this complexity and work out which part of the patchwork you're in simply goes away. You're within that. And that's why there's been such an emphasis on it over the last few years, when we, from 2016, and we realised that it wouldn't just affect mutual exclusive clauses between the UK and Mexico, which weren't sort of a huge focus before then, but would apply to a number of different countries. Now, of course, there are issues, a few wrinkles, risks to look at in terms of the Hague Choice of Court Convention. The biggest of those is actually something that has already been a risk in this area for several years and has been a problem with the Brussels regulation and a number of third countries, which is asymmetric clauses. And by an asymmetric clause, we mean a clause that is exclusive for one party, but non-exclusive for the other party. So you might find it, for instance, in a loan agreement where the borrower is obliged to go to a particular court, whereas the lender, under the same jurisdiction clause, is allowed to go to either any court at all that has jurisdiction, or it might be restricted to a number of different courts. That is an asymmetric clause. And the short answer as to asymmetric clauses is we don't know whether they fall within the Hague Convention or not. The likelihood is that they are outside the convention, but there is certainly English case law that goes both ways and has expressed both different opinions. And if you look at the contemporary materials around the time of the signing of the convention, they would tend to indicate that asymmetric clauses are not included. But we're waiting for a final decision on that, in each particular jurisdiction that is subject to the Hague Convention. But until then, there is certainly a big risk, even a likelihood, that an asymmetric clause will fall through the Hague Convention, and we'll be looking at the next stage, the common law. The next wrinkle is another one that Elizabeth mentioned, which is the start date. So the UK first became a party to the Hague Convention as a member of the EU on the 1st of October 2015. And then following Brexit, it became a member in its own right on the 1st of January 2021. And the question is for the what is the appropriate start date? So for contracts that are entered into. Not an issue if you're negotiating a contract now and about to sign a jurisdiction clause now, but for a dispute for a contract that's already been entered into, if it's between that period of 1st October 2015 and 1st January 2021, is it covered by the Hague Convention? This is a question where there are at least two very clear answers, and unfortunately they're contradictory. So there's still, let's say, some doubt overall. From a UK perspective, it's quite clear that the appropriate date is the 1st of October 2015, because that is what's set out in the legislation and in the documents that the UK submitted when they acceded to the Hague Convention. That is certainly not clear from the European perspective. As Elizabeth said, the Commission indicated that they thought that the appropriate date would be the 1st of January 2021. This is a matter that from EU member states' perspective falls within the competence of the CJEU. So there may be a CJEU decision in the future that decides on what the appropriate start date is from the perspective of member state courts. Until that's resolved, uncertainty from the EU side, if not the UK side, just remains. As to what that appropriate start date is. And the only other place that you might sort of fall through, or it's not immediately clear, is interim relief, which is excluded from the ambit of the Hague Convention. That doesn't mean that interim relief won't be given. It will just become a matter of local law. It doesn't fall within the Hague Convention. So those are the few wrinkles, risks to bear in mind. But apart from that, the Hague Convention is a safe harbour for your exclusive clauses.
It's interesting, isn't it, Adam, that the Hague Convention, certainly from where I've been sitting, has been referred to a lot in the post-Brexit landscape as in the context of reassurance that all is not lost by not having the Lugano Convention to hand, and indeed the recast Brussels regulation to hand. What in your view do you think is sort of the most significant kind of health warning that people should bear in mind when advising on Hague out of all of those different ones? Which do you think is probably going to be practically the most significant?
The asymmetric clause is the one that we're advising on the most at the moment. Last year there was an issue with the dates that was understood, and there were various drafting workarounds that people were considering or not considering. And most people actually sort of shrugged and didn't take the risk there. But there are certain practice areas and, you know, loan agreements in particular, the, you know, LMA standard loan agreement and others, where, you know, the ability to enforce using Hague is important. Asymmetric clauses are important. And it simply seems to be a judgment issue. There is a real benefit of having an asymmetric clause. Are you willing to give up that benefit because of a particular risk? And then it comes down to, well, what, you know, what is that risk? And you have to get into exactly what you said about the complexities and the local laws. And often you find that, in fact, that risk is fairly small or sort of obscure, abstract, and it's not worth giving up the very real advantage of the asymmetric clause. But we'll maybe there will be a movement in the market there. Maybe there will be more exclusive clauses. I don't know if you've seen a sort of a similar market movement.
I've seen, again, certainly over the last couple of weeks even, certainly more queries coming from transactional colleagues who are facing questions from counterparties about whether or not a move to exclusive is in fact advisable, where you know you'll be enforcing in a member state that recognises Hague, and whether or not you would benefit therefore by having an exclusive choice of court agreement such that any judgment obtained pursuant to that exclusive choice of court agreement in the English courts would therefore potentially be much more easily and readily enforceable in that member state than otherwise. So again, I think at the moment what we've got is an increase in the number of queries that are coming through. I haven't seen any wholesale move to English exclusive choice of court clauses from asymmetric. I think also part of that is what is industry standard. So as you say, in the LMA, an asymmetric clause is standard in as much as it gives flexibility to parties in relation to where to bring proceedings, particularly given arrangements regarding collateral and security. So that I haven't seen a move away from, because again, what you lose by way of flexibility, yes, you may gain in terms of, shall we say, a little bit more foreseeability regarding the process in the absence of Lugano. But I think certainly from what I've seen, those moves have not yet crystallised. They haven't yet been made. The other point that comes up as well is the Hague 2019 Convention, which has been referenced a lot more recently as something that may prove to be a bit of a solution in the future. And I'd just be interested from your perspective, Adam, what you think, how likely that is that the Hague 2019 Convention can answer some of these questions.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it would. And there's been a lot of focus on it, and from sort of academics, certainly in the UK, trying to input into that and come up with a regime that could work and, yeah, be a silver bullet to a large extent. I am cautious about the rate of adoption of these conventions generally. Yes. And, yeah, that. The Hague Choice of Court Convention has been a pleasant surprise, and there's, you know, Service Convention as well. But generally, it's an uphill battle, and the 2019 Convention, being bigger in scope, is a more difficult battle. I think it's that may help and move us back to sort of a more rules based approach. I wonder if there's a, sort of a, almost a difference in philosophy there, where we've moved out, and as you went through all the rules that we're leaving behind, they're very much a carefully circumscribed rules-based approach that works well for a number of different countries that have to cooperate with each other, and there's a certain fear in moving away from that. Common law lawyers are more used to a more sort of discretionary, less rules-based approach. So a lot of the queries we've been getting are less from the common law lawyers and more from civil law lawyers who are more focused on trying to get us back into a rules-based regime like the Hague Convention. I wonder if you've seen any difference there in sort of civil law, common law approach.
I think I have. I've certainly learned a lot more about the civil law approach to matters generally, particularly when trying to fully understand how, and this is going back to governing law, how mandatory provisions of local law may apply in certain instances if you're looking at the potential for example, an English law governed contract to be considered by, let's say, a German court or a Spanish court or an Italian court. And so reminded again of how our approaches between a common law and a civil law jurisdiction are really quite different in terms of how we even approach matters of interpretation. So that's been a very constructive exercise, I think, certainly in looking to see how, as you say, we can bring these together in the future landscape. And I think going back to Hague 2019, I entirely agree with you that, shall we say, the pace of change is something I equally am concerned about. Particularly given that the Choice of Court Convention 2005 was not, in fact, did not actually enter into force until 2015. So assuming a decade-long process awaits us, then yes, the 2019 Hague Convention, I agree with you entirely, will be quite a silver bullet in many respects, but one that we can possibly hope to look for, one would anticipate, when a lot of these problems may have already been put to bed, as it were, by a resolution on Lugano or otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, mandatory rules under governing law is a good example, because it was the English rules on applying sort of foreign mandatory rules for performance in other jurisdictions that led to a lot of the discussion and debate as to whether the UK would join in with the Rome regulation and its predecessors as well, and influence the drafting there. And you sort of see the collision between the common law and the civil law approaches to it, and perhaps a way that they can influence each other and end up with something better as a result. So if we see divergence, it perhaps be in that sort of area, and it's a shame not to have that cross-fertilization.
Yes, no, I entirely agree with you, Adam.
Yeah. So the possibly the Hague Convention in certain situations, and the other regimes that Elizabeth has been talking about. But if you don't have any of those to apply in the UK, you are then through to the regime for common law jurisdiction and enforcement. So turning to that now and that situation, again, we said that we would focus on what has changed and what the changes are. And apart from one specific, quite important change, which I'll come on to, the rules in English common law for jurisdiction and enforcement haven't actually changed. What has changed is an emphasis on them, and that suddenly people are examining them because the scope will be much wider for when those rules apply. So that's why there's much more of a focus on them now. Broadly speaking, you have a discretionary regime rather than a mandatory regime. So rather than specific sets of rules and trying to bring your case within a specific rule that then means that the court will accept jurisdiction, you have quite a broad set of jurisdiction rules, quite a wide net which sweeps up a lot of cases, but then a general discretion on the courts to decide whether to accept jurisdiction in a particular case, and a general discretion that is based on what they consider to be the most appropriate forum for that particular case. And they will exercise that discretion in every case, even when there is jurisdiction there, they can decide to stay proceeding if another court is a more appropriate forum. And looking at that particular fact situation, let's say an asymmetric clause, French choice of courts, and it comes before the English courts, there is no uncertainty as to the efficacy of an asymmetric clause as a matter of English law. So an English court would consider that as an exclusive court clause. And notwithstanding that they have this general discretion, they would almost certainly exercise that discretion to stay proceedings in favour of the French court that has the benefit of the exclusive clause. Because in deciding what's the most appropriate forum, a choice of the parties in an exclusive clause tends to outweigh almost every other factor. So although there's quite a different path and quite a different feel to it, and it's through a discretionary regime, the end result actually, at least from the English perspective, is very unlikely to be any different and lead to anything other than an acceptance of the primacy of that exclusive clause. Generally, just to mention that the discretionary regime, either you have to have, is based on service of process, and either you have to have permission to serve that process on a foreign defendant, or you don't. If you need permission, then you need to go to court, and you need to convince the court that the claim has got a reasonable prospect of success, and that there is a good arguable case that your claim falls within one of a number of different gateways that lead you to have jurisdiction. And then on top of that, there is this general discretion as to what is the most appropriate forum for the particular claim. If you don't need permission, you can serve process and start the claim without going through that process, which is a significant advantage, apart from anything that an initial application has to be done clearly on an ex parte basis and is subject to a duty of full and frank disclosure. So the situation where you don't need permission, that's where it falls within the Hague Convention. And then, and this is the big change from April this year, whenever there is a contractual choice of jurisdiction. So in that situation, a contractual choice of jurisdiction, you will not need permission to serve out. You can serve process outside the jurisdiction on any defendant. It doesn't mean that you're entirely outside the discretionary regime. That defendant could still come to court and argue that another country is a more appropriate forum. But as we've seen, where there's an exclusive choice of court, that is very unlikely to succeed if there's an English exclusive choice of court. So that's a scheme and quite a substantial difference. It used to be no permission required if something fell within the jurisdiction rules of the Brussels regime. Now it's just any contractual choice of jurisdiction. So that is something that will help. And then just a couple of final things to mention on the common law regime. Enforcement is covered by that as well. And there are a set of bilateral treaties which enable registration of foreign judgments. If you it's a country that doesn't fall within one of those bilateral treaties, then enforcement is still possible, achievable through starting new proceedings that don't have to reconsider the merits. And that, again, is something that, while a less smooth procedure than under Brussels, is a very common procedure and is something that's done, for instance, with judgments from the US and other jurisdictions. And then finally, Elizabeth was mentioning the importance of deciding initially on strategy and tactics and looking at the different risks. And an important part of that risk portfolio is the ability of the English courts to grant anti-suit injunctions. An anti-suit injunction is an injunction on a party to proceedings in a foreign court to discontinue those proceedings, not to take any further steps in those proceedings or not to start proceedings. So it acts on that foreign party and prevents those prevents them from taking part in foreign proceedings. It's an injunction that the English courts have developed over several hundred years and is something that they will deploy in many cases where there are tactical issues over rival jurisdiction clauses or rival courts and parallel proceedings. It is a power that they were largely prevented from using within the context of the Brussels regime, where it was inconsistent with the Brussels regime to courts to be granting anti-suit injunctions for courts in other jurisdictions. But obviously that doesn't apply anymore. So the use of the anti-suit injunction will be, we think, increasingly important. So that's the common law regime. Again, once you've drilled down to the details, it's surprising how many fact situations will actually end up with the same result. But it does have a different feel to it because it's a discretionary regime.
Just picking up on that penultimate point there, Adam, about anti-suit injunctions, I've certainly seen a lot more queries about the process for obtaining an anti-suit injunction and where it could apply. In terms of the types of, shall we say, practical points that that practitioners should bear in mind when advising on an anti-suit injunction process, shall we say, as being one of a number of tools in one's arsenal regarding litigation strategy. What do you think are sort of the key practical points people should maybe bear in mind in relation to those?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two. Firstly, speed. One of the key things that the court will look at is how quickly the parties acted, and if there's any sort of delay, whether there's a justification for that, or were they taking part in the foreign proceedings until they decided that things weren't going very well, so suddenly they've turned up at the English courts to get an anti-suit. That is unlikely to lead to success. So you need to act quickly. That's a general point as well, because there are, you know, provisions under the Brussels regime where starting proceedings in another court might help you out. So I think we're going to see more quick action. It's unfortunate, really, leading to a regime where there's a sort of an incentive for people to start proceedings quickly. But that's where we are. So one is speed, and the other one is, again, this duty of full and frank disclosure. And that can be a bit uncomfortable. Possibly the most uncomfortable part is that you have to set out the arguments of the other side. So you have to sit down and consider what, you know, if you're the claimant, what the defendant's arguments are, and then to actually set those out in the, you know, the relevant witness statements. And that is, you know, tactically can be a bit of a
uncomfortable
thing. Uncomfortable, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, potential you know, liability there if there's any failings in that full and frank disclosure, that is quite onerous. So those are the, you know, sort of the limitations in it, but that's a quite an important area.
Yeah. And moving on to our final slide now, for the purposes of this webinar, which is on Lugano. So we've mentioned it already in this presentation, and as matters currently stand, and this is in March 2021, we don't yet have any indication as to whether or not the EU is going to agree to the UK's accession to the Lugano Convention. And as we mentioned earlier on, it is a requirement that those countries that have acceded to the Lugano Convention need to effectively approve the UK's accession. And we most recently had, I think it was this week or last week, Switzerland indicate that they were approving the UK's accession. The EU, I think, in theory, is meant to come out with a statement at some point in the next few weeks to indicate whether or not they are inclined to agree to the UK's accession. As matters currently stand, I am of the personal view that I think that statement is not going to be forthcoming. It's clear that the negotiations are ongoing regarding the UK's accession. I think that it is also political hot point, if you will, in negotiations. And I think as a result, it may be some time before we learn of whether or not the EU is going to approve the UK's accession. Now, that's the sort of current status, and I hope I don't sound too pessimistic in that regard, but I think one needs to be realistic about how long this process may indeed take. It's not going to be anything that is going to be particularly quick, I don't think. Once approved, whenever that may be, the Lugano Convention would apply to the recognition enforcement of judgments and jurisdiction clauses between the UK, the EU and the AFTA states, and indeed would be incredibly helpful in continuing, shall we say, a form of the legislative regime that we have been used to for such a long time between the UK, the EU and the AFTA states. In terms of the protections in relation to parallel proceedings and this pendants, again, the Lugano Convention does not offer as comprehensive coverage, shall we say, as the recast Brussels regulations. So some of the points that Adam was talking about regarding interim relief from the English courts may still be relevant issues that you may want to consider, even if we do have the UK's accession to the Lugano Convention approved by the EU. So that's just something on a practical point to bear in mind regarding the Lugano Convention, but it's certainly something for everyone to keep an eye out for over the coming months.
And I think I don't think you're being pessimistic at all. I think you're being realistic. I entirely
Indeed.
agree that in the current sort of climate, it seems difficult to see Lugano coming along quickly.
That's exactly right. And I think it's interesting as well because, certainly from what I've seen from the Law Society and various other industry groups and the Ministry of Justice, significant efforts have been made to, shall we say, expedite the Lugano process. But it is now part of the political negotiations with the EU. And I think that is not something that one can expedite beyond a certain point.
And if we get to that, we will all be pleased, and it will feel, I suppose, a bit like being in the Brussels regime 10 years ago,
Exactly.
where we all, we got on with it and it was fine, as you know, to the extent I can remember that. And we will have to compare that with where we are now, which is more complicated and has its pluses and minuses. But I'm not sure it's 100% clear whether it would be better or worse.
Indeed. And as you said before, what the legislative landscape actually looks like in 5 to 10 years' time when you take into account the Hague 2019 convention, and indeed not to undermine either the possibility of bilateral treaties being negotiated and implemented between the UK and individual member states, is something else that may indeed occur in due course, so something to bear in mind.
And that kind of brings us to, to what I would conclude from this, which is that things have changed. It is more complicated, but apart from the various wrinkles that we described and new risks here and old risks there, it's surprising how much hasn't changed in terms of where most fact situations would end up. So we've tried to set out some of those wrinkles, but it's important not to have a knee-jerk reaction. And to throw out some of the positives of governing laws and jurisdictions, but to accept that we're in a more complicated situation. And
I would entirely agree with that, Adam. And I think that from a practical perspective, looking at the types of points you really want to take away from this webinar, it is that there is an increasingly complex process that seems to be coming out in relation to recognition enforcement of English choice of court clauses and judgments in order to ensure that you have assessed and ID'd, identified and appropriately defined what those risks are is something that is an incredibly important exercise. And that to the extent that there are any risks, that appropriate mitigants are highlighted to whether it be internal stakeholders if you're in-house or indeed your external clients if you're in private practice. And having, as Adam said, that measured view of what the practical effect of this is and steering clear of any knee-jerk reactions is very important. And as ever, just keeping an ear out for the latest developments from Europe as we remain optimistic that there will be some form of resolution coming in the next few months. In the interim, I think we will all need to be prepared to deliver advice on the topics we've covered today with increasing frequency. So I think with that, we thank you very much for listening to this webinar and we hope it's been useful.